topic for discussion today is models and reality. So, there's kind of a ongoing tension in many fields of research between mathematical models that we use to try to define reality and data collection approaches, where we are doing experiments and collecting a bunch of data and then trying to figure out what all of those things mean.
There is a world beyond what you see and what you hear, beyond the comfort of your daily life, beyond the confines of ordinary reality. This world is all around you, at all times, if only you dare to look below the surface, let go of what you think you know, and join us in a world of endless wonder on the Quest Podcast.
All right. Okay. I'm Danan Deneve. I'm a doctoral student at UC Merced, and I'm an evolutionary ecologist. Anybody?
Yeah, sure. I'm Taryn Rowlings. I'm also a doctoral student at UC Merced, and I study food web ecology.
I'm Jonathan Anzules. I study immunology. I collect data from immunological systems and try to make a mathematical model out of it.
Great.
And I think I should add this. I think me and Taryn were in similar pants.
You are wearing pretty similar pants. Thank you for noting this. This is important.
You have fine taste.
Yeah. Hi, I'm Nate Fox. I am a doctoral student, also at UC Merced, and I am an Ice Age mammal paleontologist.
Goodness, snakes. We're getting more specific.
Oh, yeah. I think it changes every week. It's like it gets a little more specific.
Like that. Later it's just going to be like...
Right, you're going to have this chronology of my job titles.
It's going to be like a long, weird joke.
I envy those people whose career, like their field of study fits really neatly into like a tight little box where they can say something and then other people know immediately what they actually do.
Does that actually exist?
I think...
Not for us.
I think in degree, right? I don't think there's a lot of people who say... I think there are people who can say things like, I study cancer.
Yeah. Okay, that's fair.
You know what I mean? And they can convey a lot of information. When I'm talking to people and I'm like, I make mathematical models about ecosystems that don't exist anymore. Most people have no idea what on earth I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Sort of like what Jonathan was saying, right? It's a similar, like, man, I do some like mathy, modely stuff. I don't know. But
yeah, no, I get a lot of the same thing. People are like, well, what does that mean? And I'm like, well, I do some paleo, and I do some modern ecology, and I do a lot of evolutionary biology, and I do this other random shit, and folks are just like, that's not real.
Weasels. Everything weasels.
Yes, and I'm just like, weasels, otters, done.
Yeah, makes sense to me.
Yeah.
I think the people who could say, like, something easy and simple, like cancer, like you said, there's, you could just say that and convey a lot of information. I feel like they just say that to people who don't know the field of cancer.
Totally.
Because they could easily go dive into the rabbit hole of what cancer studies
are. Cancer's just one thing, right? There's it's one simple thing, and there's only one way to study it.
That's why we fixed it already.
That's why it gets cured every other week on the internet.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. We're done with that. Not a problem.
So, like, if I talk to somebody who doesn't know anything about what I do or anything about sciences, I just say, I'm an immunologist, I study the immune system.
Yeah.
That's it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to confuse you anymore.
Yeah.
I'll say that. Because if you start going into, like, explaining what you're doing, then it starts turning into a lecture, and then I don't want to go into that conversation.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And literally nobody cares.
Nobody cares.
I mean, I study otters, and everybody is immediately...
Yeah, I bet.
They're just like... Tell me everything.
I study Volt. Yeah.
I want to say, Nate, do you get the same reaction to Volts? No.
Why not?
That's why I just cut it off at Ice Age Mammals. That's about as cool as it gets.
No.
That's more accurate anyway, because you don't care about the voles either.
No. Wait, are we still recording?
Anyway, the topic for discussion today is models and reality. So, there's kind of a ongoing tension in many fields of research between mathematical models that we use to try to define reality and data collection approaches, where we are doing experiments and collecting a bunch of data and then trying to figure out what all of those things mean. So generally, we there's a couple kind of ways you can do it. There's the way that makes sense, where somebody does a bunch of experiments and comes up with some things, and then somebody else, or maybe that same person, but probably somebody else, uses that data from a bunch of experiments to try to make a model that predicts those things. And then there's the other way, where the experimentalists do a bunch of experiments and get data, and the modelers just make a bunch of models and you know, produce a model that may or may not mean something, and then these things sometimes meet up and sometimes don't. So,
I got a question, maybe a comment. It's like, when it comes to modeling, I feel like whenever we, like, in terms of, like, any time you look at humans trying to understand something, there's always, like, a model that they try to do. It doesn't necessarily have to be, like, a mathematical model. You could have, like, just an image of, like, things connecting to each other to see, like, to if you could, like, congregate or, like, coalesce all of this data that you put together. And then you put it into, like, an image and then see if you could actually understand the bigger picture. I think the goal is always just to understand the bigger picture and how things are connected to each other. So, like, it's, I guess right now what we, when it comes to the struggle, what we're trying to, like, connect between each other is trying to, like, connect reality of, like, what we're doing and collecting and the system that we're collecting, and trying to represent it in a mathematical model that actually does something, right? As opposed to just a picture that's just static.
Yeah.
And trying to recreate life and what the complexity of reality is. It's almost like nearly impossible, and there will be so many like parts where we just fail.
But that's what's beautiful, the futility of it all.
Because if you do represent, you do find this sweet equation to represent whatever model you're like working on, there's always going to be somebody, but you're not considering this. Yeah, that we could have fit that in this model.
Yeah.
That wouldn't work. We don't want that.
Yeah.
So then it's almost like the model we're making is what we think reality should be.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to what it is sometimes. I don't know. So.
I guess I have a question for you based on some of the stuff you were talking about earlier. You work on species distribution models in some cases, right?
Sometimes.
So when you're doing that, what are you trying to know by doing that?
So species distribution modeling is where you basically get a bunch of information about where I'm gonna say a critter, as I've noted in
the technical term.
Previous things, when I say critter, I mean any living thing, but what I personally mean is a mammal of some kind, because I am way too mammal-centric. Anyway, so you get a bunch of information about where a critter occurs, so what this critter's actual distribution is like, and then you are trying to associate that to environmental data of some variety. So maybe it's climate, maybe it's things like habitat type, vegetation type, whether or not the habitat's been disturbed, stuff like that. And what I'm trying to, and then you can do other things with this, like you can predict it into the future, or you can predict it into the past. So the idea is that you come up with, like, a set of variables that are, like, these are the variables that affect the distribution of this animal, whatever, that are probably going to continue to affect the distribution of this critter that we need to keep an eye on, to know how its range might change in the future. So what I'm trying to do when I'm modeling otters is figure out what kinds of environmental variables are important to them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, like, do they care about how many humans are in an area, or do they care what the temperature is? Stuff like that.
Right.
And that, for what I'm doing, is all I'm trying to accomplish. So it's fairly, in terms of SDMs, it's pretty straightforward.
Yeah.
In theory.
And so if I'm understanding correctly, you, by looking at where otters live, now, or where you find fossil finds or whatever, right? Wherever you have data about the conditions under which otters are living, you record that and extrapolate to where what other places have those same conditions. Is that
That is a thing that people do.
Yeah,
it's not what I'm doing.
Okay,
I wanted to just create a basically get effectively a list of associations.
Okay.
Where, like, they always live in places that have, say, a ton of trees, or they never live in places that have a ton of trees,
right.
Or they hate humans, or something like this. And then this would just be, like, a list of things. So that when people are trying to put into place, like, conservation policies and stuff like that, they can be like, oh, look, you know, otters only like places where there is a river that is this big. And they're always going to be in a place where the river is this big. So we need to make sure that we are, like, if we want to conserve otters, keep them around, that they have access to places that are undisturbed and have a ton of food and a river that's this big.
So your output isn't a map, necessarily, but habitat suitability information, is that?
The output that I care about is habitat suitability information.
Okay.
Output is also a map.
Yeah.
And the map is how I decide, at least, whether or not the model is doing a good job. So the model tells you whether or not
Fair enough.
Yeah, you know how this is. The model tells you whether or not it thinks it's doing a good job.
Yeah.
My models tell me all the time that they are doing great.
Yeah.
But then when you look at
such
the
friendly
map,
models.
Exactly, yeah. They're just like, we're doing fantastic, how are you today? And then you look at the map that it's given you.
Right.
And the map that it says is where otters should be living, and you're just like, nah, you're not doing great, actually, at all. You've missed, like, this entire area where I know there's, like, a crazy ton of otters.
Right.
Something is wrong with you.
Yeah. So you're abstracting over the, like, real requirements and experiences of life as an otter into some, like, list that's understandable by humans and that can allow us to make predictions about what places are and what conditions are good for otters.
Exactly. So I'm basically looking for, like, a list of niche requirements.
Yeah. Very cool. I think something I like about that sort of habitat suitability models for a discussion about modeling in general is that I think maps are one of the easiest ways to explain to people who don't do modeling work what models are and what they're for.
Yeah.
And that idea of abstraction and simplification, right? Where, you know, a map, just not a, like, detailed habitat suitability map, but just a normal humans navigating around the environment map is a model, and a very important kind of model for, you know, the development of human societies and stuff, where we take something super complex, which is, well, super large too, right? Which is space on Earth, and we compress it down into, you know, some horribly folded piece of paper with a lot of drawings and weird little symbols on it, and we use our understanding of the model to make predictions about our movement in space based on this model that we're holding.
Yeah.
And I think particularly for this idea of the amount of simplification that goes into model, and this is the hard part to get across and be like, for people like me who do modeling, to be like, no, there's utility here, I swear. Because I'm sympathetic to people who work just in data being like, what the fuck are you doing? Like, I'm sympathetic. I really am. Like,
that's what I really wanted both of you.
I'm sympathetic, but I think the map analogy is really good for being like, we can make a lot of simplifications about large, complex systems. We're losing a ton of important detail, right? Like, there is a really big difference between a piece of paper that has a map on it and real space, right? We're losing a ton of information, but still being able to, with that really, really simplified model of space, the fact that we can navigate around and somewhat reliably, some of us can get ourselves from A to B based on that information, is valuable and important. And I think that's why I like these sorts of habitat suitability species distribution models, is that, like, you know, showing this progression smoothly up to the people who do modeling that's way more like abstract theory-based stuff than what I do, even.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, math from first principles and not really that directly concerned with data at all. No, that's really interesting. Do you find modeling comes up in your work much?
Not in the same way that you guys do modeling. So actually, I have a question about the distribution models. And you mentioned that you have these outputs, and they all think that they're great, even if they're not great.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any kind of another measure that you can, like, that gets generated with the models to determine whether they are actually great or not great? Like, some kind of a posterior probability where it's like, hey, I think this is happening, but I'm only, you know, like 60% sure that this is happening. So, for example, in my analyses, like using my morphometric data on Volte to try to classify fossil species, I usually run that data through a discriminant analysis, and that discriminant analysis will sort. Then it'll be like, okay, based on these modern voles that we have here with these, you know, tooth shapes, we think that the fossil is either this species or this species. And it'll usually give me like this table that shows like the two top picks. So it'll be like what it classified it as, and then the second closest species out of your choices that you give it. But these classifications aren't all created equal, because one, let's say, you know, one vole is classified as, you know, species A, and the other one is classified as species A also. But one might have a posterior probability score of 1, which is like a perfect, like 100, like the model thinks it's absolutely this one. Where the other one might have a probability score of, you know, 0.5, or they're saying it's only like 50% sure, and then the second closest species is like, you know, 0.49 or something. And then at that point, it's like, okay, well, that's really just a coin flip. So you're telling me that you're
yeah,
you think it might be this species, but you really don't know what you're talking about right now. Model, is there anything like that?
Yeah,
for your kind of models.
Yeah, so the models produce several statistics on how they think they're doing, and one is basically a posterior probability, and it still thinks that it's great a lot of times, not always. But also, the reason that my models think they're doing great when they're not is because of the quality of my input data.
Right.
which is a hump that I've been trying to find a lot of different ways to get over, and
I understand. I have the same exact problem.
Yeah, exactly. So, with mine, it's definitely an issue where, like, the quality of the input data is pretty terrible. Like, the distributions, the locality information that I have to work with is super, super patchy and really skewed. Mm-hmm. So I have input data that says there are a ton of otters in some places and not very many otters in other places where there are actually a ton of otters.
Mm.
So that's why they're not doing well. But at the same time, I wouldn't know, like, I wouldn't have any way to know that they weren't doing well if I didn't have an actual range map to compare it to. And a lot of times, like, sometimes when we're modeling something like this, we're really, really lucky, and we have an actual range map to compare it to, and we can be like, these two things don't match. I think there's something wrong. And sometimes all you have to work with is your input data. And you have no range map, and thus you have no idea whether or not things are actually okay.
I see. Yeah, I mean, in my, you know, line of work, it's really not too much better. So, like,
yeah,
for example, my discriminant analysis of modern vole species is only able to correctly classify the ones of known species affinities about 80 to 85% of the time. So even if it does generate this posterior probability of a perfect, you know, 1, for my fossils, you still have to take that with a grain of salt, because it doesn't even know all of the actual species really all that well. So
I think this is where why we even started talking about, like, what wanted to even, like, do this podcast, because coming from, like, an experimental side and actually collecting the actual data from complex systems in the world, and then looking at equations and mathematical models that have been created from the other side, and purely in the mathematical, just theoretical point of view, and then trying to find the in-between together, it's kind of hard to, like, come in between and, like, find something solid that will work for everybody, because you have these mathematical rules, these equations that and criteria that have to be met, but when you like implement it in a situation where in reality it doesn't actually fully work, like your probabilities, it's not even like as something that's reliable. You could just say it could be either an or. And I think when we started was that there's this side where they focus on making these models and they make sense to them in a terms in like a mathematical in the equation and in a purely like in like it makes sense in mathematical laws, but then they make these techniques, they say that it could represent all of these rules and all these situations, but then it's up to for the people on the other side who actually work with data to see if they can actually make it useful. So it's like this week in another team we're learning understanding and learning machine learning. And he says you can basically use it for anything. So like, I have no idea how to use this thing. It's like, I can understand you can use it for anything. You can make it predict and then and like make its own predictions. But like somebody asks, it's like, but like, how do I know which parameters I should use for this thing? How do I know how many layers in the neural network should I use? It's like, well, that, you know, yeah. It works here. But you really have to like know like how to actually change the parameters in a way to work for you.
Yeah.
I think last time we came up was like, that's why we need somebody in the middle who like does work with the data and then works with them on the theoretical side,
yeah.
Which is why I like the school, because it's kind of like that's what it wants to do, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that stuff you're talking about is deep learning specifically, right?
Yeah.
Like that stuff you're doing with Harish.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the things that's important to keep in mind too is there's a lot more divisions than this, but broadly there's two big, very different ways to do modeling and kinds of models. And one of them is kind of what you guys are talking about, and actually what Jonathan's talking about too there, this like machine learning statistical approach where you acquire a bunch of data and then you try and fit a mathematical framework to that data that then reproduces mm-hmm. those patterns.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what a lot of like crazy deep learning stuff does, right? You, so I've done like, I've taken his deep learning class and done some machine learning work in my own. I was wondering what was happening there for a second.
Don't worry about it. Just
collecting a big pile of data, right? You break it into a training set and a test set, and you try and fit a model to the training set.
Yeah.
And then you test it against the test set, which the data hasn't seen, and you get some sort of accuracy measure back.
Yeah, but you have to understand how to actually break down your data in a way that makes sense in the machine learning world.
Absolutely. The machine learning data science stuff is the vast majority of that is how do I make my data do the things that I want? like that's really, you know,
this is the question that haunts my dreams.
The models, those types of like machine learning models and stuff, you know, especially if you're not at the bleeding edge of that research, so much of it is pre-canned, people who know way more about it than we ever will have given you good parameters of how to do it. It's just getting your data structured properly in a way that lets you actually ask the questions.
Which is like a career in and of itself. Just like knowing like structured data. It's
for
just
sure.
like an entire career.
Cleaning data is really annoying. But
fuck cleaning data.
But the other thing that I want to say is that there's a lot of modeling. So most of the modeling that I do is not really structured that way. You know, and most of this type of like food web ecology modeling and lots of other type of modeling, you don't really start with data and then fit math to data, because you're not trying to describe pattern and reproduce pattern necessarily. What you're trying to go from is your understanding of the mechanisms underlying what's going on, and representing those as math and then seeing what math tells you about what we should expect, at least in qualitative terms, right? So, you know, like this stuff that I'm doing, and you have to be, and I think most of the people who do this kind of research, especially, you know, the work that I'm doing is food web models of paleo ecosystems. There's no way to do, like, starting with a huge pile of robust, highly certain data and then describe that with a nice statistical, like, no, it's not it's not one of the options.
Yeah.
And so if we want to recognizing the amount of uncertainty that's going on here, right? If we want to have some understanding of how these systems maybe behaved at macro scales, right? So, like, what were their stability what might their stability properties have been like? How could they function qualitatively? So I don't know of anybody who's done paleo food web modeling and be like, no, no, this is a precise numerical prediction of population abundances based on my, you know, perfect genius with the mathematics. I don't think anyone's done, like, anyone has that stance. But it's just about, you know, is this, in the way that I have represented this mathematically, you know, if my math, like, everything crumples down to extinction once you add humans... maybe that gives us information about what happened in these systems at certain times. But it's starting with, you know, this is information we have about how these types of species interact. If we're talking about predator-prey interactions, we know that certainly for modern animals, especially modern terrestrial mammals, but lots of things, most of these predator-prey interactions are based on size, right? Most of who you murder with your mouth and consume is based on how big they are in comparison to you. And there's some other things like sociality and weird specific traits that go into it, but that's most of it. And so we can be reasonably safe propagating that through time, representing that mathematically and building networks or, you know, big things of coupled differential equations and seeing, okay, if we know these animals are there because awesome paleontologists who like to go digging around in caves and dirt have collected this awesome information for us. You know, if we know that these species are here, and so we've got, you know, like Arctotis, giant short-faced bears and stuff. We know that, you know, we can be, even if they're omnivores, we can be confident they're eating some meat or something that we know is definitely obligate carnivora, you know, Smilodon or something. We know how big they are. We know that they're eating tons of meat. And so we can make okay-ish predictions about what they were eating and based on modern animals, how that might work. And just going off these, what we think the mechanisms were, we can then go see, okay, assuming these mechanisms are somewhat accurate, what do we expect macro scale out of this system? And it's a little different than doing this kind of like predictive statistical stuff where you collect a big pile of data. I would rather do, like, personally, the kind of stuff you're talking about. It's just not possible. Like, I really like machine learning and deep learning stuff. If somebody could give me a data set, like a deep learning sized data set of predator-prey interactions in the fucking late Pleistocene, I'd be really into it. It's just not an option.
Is it feasible with what you're doing to build models based on present, or how much of this goes into it, like building models based on present interspecies interactions in as much as what they exist analogous systems, and then trying to reflect those back to the systems that no longer exist? So, like, building the model and being like, how well does this explain what we see with, like, modern sets of critters?
Yeah, so I mean, one of the things that you have to do is you still have parameters, right? And so even if we're like, okay, like, we think multiply these things together and, like, see what happens, there's still parameters in there, you know, these...
I'm just laughing because that's pretty much my ecological dynamics final.
Right? Yeah.
What parameters exist?
Multiplying things until... Multiplying the numbers until it makes sense.
Yeah. Multiply abundances or densities together and then throw a parameter at it. Yeah. No, but I mean, these, you know, old school Lacovolterra style... Predator-prey interaction stuff.
Define for our listeners Lacovolterra models.
Sure. So this is it's got to be like 100 years old now.
Yeah.
Some differential equations, fancy calculus if you haven't done any differential equations, that just describes what happens to the density of organisms if one of those is a predator, one of those is a prey, and it gives you a few different parameters in there. There's like we fiddle around with some density dependence, birth and death rates, and then there's attack rates of the predator on the prey and conversion efficiencies of, you know, turning prey into more predators through reproduction and making biomass and this kind of stuff. But those parameters, right? So abundances and stuff we can play around with lots of different ways, but parameters, you have to get those from somewhere.
Yeah.
And so this is, I think, where it comes up to. So what we end up doing a lot is be like, well, okay, the only real Pleistocene-style terrestrial ecosystem we have left is the Serengeti in parts of East Africa.
Yeah.
And as my PI has a bunch of experience there, that and it's actually not just my PI, but most of the, I think, the people who are doing these kind of things, when we're trying to understand something like La Brea, right, the site that we're working on, there are a lot of structural food web similarities between La Brea and East Africa.
Okay, so that is why you're doing...
Yeah, and so we tend to take parameters, right? So because all these people who have done food webby stuff and taken parameters and body size relationships and stuff out of systems like the Serengeti and given us those numbers, and so we go, ha-ha. and use those, right? Try and get information from modern systems as much as we can, so it's not just things removed from our own bodies.
Yeah.
There's definitely two different sort of approaches to this. And unfortunately, I don't have much experience in how it's this type of modeling is approached in physics, but that general idea of, okay, let's assume the mechanisms work like X and Y, and let's see what that would mean. All resting on the idea that mathematics makes accurate representations of how reality works.
So that's what we're trying to do in my lab. I mean, the goal was at least my first project that was supposed to end last year. I'm still building the data for it, and it probably continue till the summer and maybe pass. But like the initial goal was that I collect the data, and the data was supposed to be easy to collect.
It's not supposed to be allocated. I'd be instantly suspicious anytime somebody told me data was going to be easy to collect.
Right,
and also my own unconscious resistance to like not wanting to do experiments also plays a huge role. But still, the core of it was
I'll trade you
to collect the data and then structure the data set that I'm collecting in such a way where I can make a model. I'm going to start out with a Locke Volterra model of just like showing growth rates of different cellular populations. But like at the end goal of this project was to like get a model that would be a representation of the development of the immune system, which is what I'm modeling, and see which parts of the actual immune system is susceptible to perturbations. Because when perturbations happens, there's a chance that autoimmune disease will develop. So the model would serve in this way to like help us make a hypothesis of like what part of the development of the immune system should we focus on? Because there's so many things you could focus on, right? But if we collect enough factors, enough ideas, we could like make a model based on systems and equations that have been used mostly in ecology, mm-hmm. that has a lot of different equations that you use on, or just inspired from somebody else, from something else. That's what I'm going to do, because I don't know enough about mathematics to like come up with my own equation. Well, I know enough, a little bit. So
just make your own whole field of mathematics. Like,
yeah, why aren't you doing that? No. God.
I'm integrating so many different careers, and I'm like the only one that understands that I'm combining so many different fucking things.
Yeah, about that.
But like the pretty idea, the one that's attractive to immunologists, the one they want mathematicians to work, is like to help make a hypothesis of what like should happen. And then what we should focus on, instead of like wasting our efforts on like, oh, let me try this and see what happens. And then money gets wasted there. Yeah. Oh, let me see if I can try this. And then money gets wasted there. And then it's just focus down and narrow down our future visions. We don't expect it to be accurate, but it should be accurate enough to like narrow our field of vision of where we should go forward. And that's what my PhD will be focused on. See if we can narrow people's view of the future. Mm-hmm.
I mean, some really important work has been done with modeling of the way that you're describing it in disease research. I unfortunately can't remember the details, but as I understand it, some of the early work done on HIV and making predictions about how HIV was working and why it was as infectious and hard to get rid of as it is was done in this way of starting with first principles, making like, okay, let's assume that it's working like this, reproducing, especially at these sorts of rates, and making some inferences mm-hmm. about, in order to produce the kind of dynamics that we're experiencing and seeing in patients, that it must have like this insane reproductive
rate. Yeah, yeah.
And work in these weird spikes and collapses that end up getting verified by people doing the nasty work of experimentation and collecting data.
You know what? I just realized this like huge decisions that are made on mathematical models, right? There's enormous decisions that are being made. Like there's somebody who did a mathematical equation that represents how much of like a certain drug a person should get, and that's how much that's the standard they set for everybody for whatever disease it is. And then there is like when it comes to conservation or conservation, right? There's some sort of somebody did some sort of equation. They found what is an ideal number of like certain fish that can be fished, right? Mm-hmm. Somebody made that decision based on some sort of mathematical equation saying that this is how much you should take. You should not take anything more or else the whole system will collapse.
Fisheries, right? Is all modeling, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. And then there's also like, I used to think when I was in undergrad, I thought like people who went into like finance, they were just like people who like go on the phones and try to talk to people and make sales. But then I got into a conversation with somebody who actually did finance, and he just started going into these details, like very detailed and technical discussions of like these models that he was working on, mm-hmm. of like financial systems and what predictions they can make based on these models. And it's like, I guess it's this like hard, I guess in the conversations that I have been in, I haven't like been in a conversation where somebody can actually appreciate how much like influence these models have made in our lives, mm-hmm. I guess, because decisions are made on what these predictions, these models are predicted.
Yeah, dude, finance, especially like quants in finance, like the people who do the quantitative finance stuff, half those dudes are like applied math, physics backgrounds.
I had no idea. I would have made a career choice.
Way to go get paid after grad school.
I honestly thought it was people in suits talking on the fucking phone. I didn't realize they were working with very technical shit.
No, they're shaving microseconds off transactions.
Yeah.
That's what they're doing.
Like this guy's telling me
Bayesian algorithms.
He was looking at like multiple screens and see if like how mm-hmm. everything is going on the equation.
Seeing how to get paid.
Yeah. Mathematically.
Yeah.
And then like, it makes sense to me now why they make like over $100,000 as soon as they graduate from undergrad.
I mean, for people really deep in the technical world, it's like quants and stuff like that, the idea that we're even talking about $100,000 like it's a lot of money is funny to them. I have friends who make fun of me a lot for going to grad school. They're assholes.
Yeah, they're assholes and you should hate them. It's the only logical response.
Shut up, what if I don't want any money?
More important things than money.
Yeah.
What was that paper like we were talking about?
The Babaroosa.
The Babaroosas. So you gotta explore the Babaroosas. Why do their teeth grow to your skull?
Maybe I am a Babaroosa.
Shh. Your dog's cute.
Your teeth are just slowly growing into your skull.
Metaphorically.
Yeah, clearly.
Yeah. Hopefully my teeth aren't growing inward.
I think my synthesis take-home message, I guess, from this talk we've had today is that, at least in my opinion, it seems like the most informative studies are the ones that combine, you know, theoretical and practical data.
Oh, yeah.
So, like, because,
yeah,
you know, both have their strengths and drawbacks. And, like, for mm-hmm. example, getting back to the La Brea thing, I'm on the practical side. The data mule who's just harvesting the data, and then you are on the theoretical side and, you know, doing your sorcery and but, you know, we're trying to answer different questions.
So weeping into my herbivory model.
I'm trying to put like little pieces of the puzzle together at La Brea, you know, using real in quotes data, whereas you're trying to solve the sort of like big picture thing. But you can bounce the two back on each other.
Yeah.
Like, you know, basically use my...
Actually, this is a really, really good...
Right, of real data to see how robust your models are and whether they actually... It seems like they are modeling something realistic or not. So, you know, I have my abundance data, my shape data, my dietary data through stable isotopes, so chemical analysis. But all those, you know, are working with fossil data, which is inherently biased and super fragmented and subject to a variety of alterations from just depositional and taphonomic processes. And I'm getting just these, you know, these little pieces of data on individual critters or a few individuals within different critters. But, you know, like I said, we could check, bounce that back on the two models. So, like, you could have let's say your model predicts that, you know, after this big environmental perturbation, so this, a catastrophe, like maybe right after the end of the ice age, you know, a coyote switched from eating, let's say, larger megafauna to rabbits or something like that. You know, you can actually test how probable that is, but then, you know, comparing it to the quote-unquote real data that I've collected, you know, and on coyote bones to see, like, what their dietary signature was. Yeah. And if that changes through time based on, you know, radiocarbon-dated fossils, and maybe we'll be like, oh, yes, it looks like this coyote's dietary niche was overlapping with bison, you know, right before the end of the last glacial maximum catastrophe. And then after, oh, look, now they're pairing in the rabbit isotopic niche. So there are ways to, circumvent the limitations of both of our studies, yeah. But it involves the marriage between the two.
I think you're totally right. And I think you actually can't do good science properly without both.
Yeah, I completely agree.
This doesn't necessarily mean you have to be, modeling in exactly the way that I'm modeling. I think there's lots of ways to do that, but it's sort of you have to have part of it figuring out what happened or what happens, and then part of it figuring out why, right? And that's kind of like what that how I think about that relationship. And mine is super biased to ecology and evolution, because that's really all I care about.
That's three out of four of us in this room.
Yeah, no, but I mean, we're
sorry, Jonathan.
but I mean, we're all and within that, we're all biologists of some flavor, right?
Yeah.
And so there are these other big parts of science that I don't have a lot of direct contact with, but certainly for understanding things, you know, ecology, evolution, and paleontology, which are huge and messy, and even figuring out what the fuck happened is super impossibly hard half the time.
Even when you're watching it.
Exactly.
Even when you are actually literally watching it,
yeah.
Figuring out what the fuck is happening,
yeah.
It's almost impossible.
Yeah.
Let alone being like, let's figure out what the fuck was happening 30,000 years ago.
Yeah, like, and I think...
Who knows?
And I think Jonathan's stuff of, like, immune system interactions is a lot more ecological than most people even think about it, right?
Yeah.
Because there's a large predator-prey sort of element thing going on there, right?
Well, it's just, like, a lot of the models that I've seen that have been used in the immune system have gotten inspirations from, like, ecological models and dynamics.
Yeah.
Ecological models.
Yeah.
Like, there are, like, interactions where there's one cell that like kills another cell because it looks funny. They call natural killer cells. It's just like, and there's like natural killer
that
cells
never
kills things that looks funny.
Nothing awesome. Ever kills something else because it looks
it just because it looks funny. It gives off some sort of receptor and that just like targets it and marks it for death. Like
give me bad vibes.
Yeah. Bad vibes. Or
that guy just sketched me out. I'm gonna go back and
look at me sideways.
Yeah.
There's actually a lot of that happening in just like the development of the cells
toxic
because they all just look funny.
Sorry, I said toxic masculinity in the immune system.
Yeah,
that's like a good way to say it because they don't want cells that are like overly reactive.
Oh god,
to cause damage, you know, who have the potential to cause damage. Yeah. And they
this
kill
cell is
thousands
just
of cells.
Even your science is intersectional. Well done.
Great.
Removes the toxic masculinity, but it just wants enough sensitivity so it can react, not too much reaction.
Yeah,
everybody needs just a bit
of
sensitivity.
And then there's this competition for like resources, which establishes how much of the cell population should be there. You know, and there's the niches are established by signals that tell it you should be alive, and how many of those signals spread out into the entire cell population is how much of the cells exist. And this is like something that's just recently been like discovered, understood in the mathematical model, which I really enjoy the most. And it's like. And has, like, right now has, like, two or three citations because all the immunologists have, like, no idea what the fuck to do with it.
But I think this is actually another...
Someday they'll figure it out and someday it'll be huge.
I think this is another important part about how abstraction and modeling works, too, though, right? Is the fact that you can take math that was originally put together to describe something like fisheries or the cycling of lynx and hare.
Mm-hmm.
You can abstract it into math. And then it turns out that it actually, because of you're looking above the nitty-gritty details of what it is to be a lynx or a hare, right? And you're just representing some of these big picture stuff of how they interact, that those that same abstraction also can do a pretty good job of representing maybe otters and urchins, or maybe voles and
weasels,
killer dire hawks in the Pleistocene, or whatever it is, or immune system interactions, right? But this is the point, is we start with some detailed system, remove a lot of the technical stuff that we think plays only a minor role, just look at the big picture stuff, see how much of the system it describes, and then it turns out that it also applies to all these other things that, when abstracted away from the little detail stuff, have overall similar dynamics, which I think is cool and valuable about doing modeling.
Can I take a pause on this? I still have no idea what's a vole.
A vole?
Yeah. Let's not pause.
I keep hearing it, but what's a vole?
It's a type of large bear.
It's a large bear.
With teeth like this. It's like a saber-toothed cat plus bear.
Is like a type of large bear, but bears are already fucking large.
It's like a mouse with like a more boxy face and more like squat little limbs.
Is this thing still like in existence?
Oh yeah, they're still around. Yeah.
Okay.
And they have really fucked up triangular accordion looking teeth.
Oh okay.
God, their teeth.
The weirdest teeth.
So creepy.
In my opinion, I have ever seen on a mammal. What?
They're weird.
Yeah. What are you doing, evolution? Go home, you're drunk. Like, well, right. How's that useful for anything?
Right, at least it's not the bee thing, the weird pig.
The babaroosa.
Yeah, at least it's not the babaroosa.
When you said bee thing, I was thinking about bees. And I was like, I don't think bees have teeth. That doesn't make any sense to me, but yeah.
Bees definitely have teeth. You didn't know bees had teeth. little
bony teeth.
Right.
Sorry.
Yeah.
I needed to have some image of what a bowl was as a kept hearing. Mm-hmm.
But yeah, they're like mice.
But what I think about mathematical models and why, like, you know, how I was saying before, decisions are really made is because there is, like, you know, there is some constraint to how, like, big an animal can be. Like, physically, there is a limitation to how big they can be, mm-hmm. according to, like, the laws of, like, thermodynamics and gravity and chemistry and whatever else you want to consider. Like, there is, like, some numerical representation of, like, what's happening in the real world. Like, there's like, a numerical representation of how big a cell can be. Because if it's any bigger, it'll just, like, it won't be able to hold it well and just break. If it's any smaller, I don't know what happens. It just can't be any smaller.
Yeah.
I don't know that much detail. But there's enough of like, and understanding a consensus within people that there is like some sort of like principles or rules or like that can be understood mathematically, and if you use these things, you could, and it could help you bring insight into what is actually going on in the systems. Mm-hmm. And this is these rules, and the people who establish these rules are the ones who like completely focus on the theoretical mathematical side.
Yep.
Right.
Yeah.
These are the people who are like focused on trying to find and understand the world through a purely mathematical way, and then say, hey, This works mathematically. Like the local Voltaire model is like 100 years old, you said, right? It's still being used.
Yeah, yeah.
Because there is some sort of principle there that like that has been proven true for all this time, and I'm considering using it in my PhD.
Proven useful, I think, is
a better
way to run it. And I think that's what you meant.
I think
that's what you meant, but just for the purpose of having an audience.
I think
it's good to clarify. But yeah, proven useful.
Yeah.
Right?
Just to like emphasize again to the audience, there is definitely a difference between truth and usefulness. And this is part of why models are so important, is because we can never be absolutely positive. Let me just have a momentary existential breakdown. We can never be absolutely 100% completely positive about truth, because there is no 100% objective way to measure truth.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All measurements of truth that we have some degree of subjectivity, and what this means is that, like, objective is what is actually happening, and subjective basically is a measure of how much personal overlay you have on what is happening.
Reality doesn't exist.
And, reality doesn't exist. Since there is no 100% objective, completely just what is reality way of measuring reality, we can never be totally completely sure what is true. We can get to like I'm 99% sure this is true, or I'm 99.99999 whatever percent sure this is true, but you can never actually be truly 100% sure of truth. And thus usefulness is pretty damn fantastic.
Yeah.
Like, if you come up with a thing and it is a useful thing, and it appropriately predicts, or closely to appropriately predicts, what you're seeing, what you're experiencing, what your data is telling you, that alone is pretty incredible and is of far, far more use than not having a thing that can do that, even though we can never be 100% sure about anything.
Yeah. I feel like that's why mathematicians like mathematics. Because there's like a...
They don't want to be bothered with reality.
Because they can say unquestionably...
I feel like that's true, actually.
Unquestionably, this is true. I don't care about anything else. This equation and this proof that I just came up with is true. Yeah. This is my reality. But then I remember getting into discussion before that you could go into such a deep level of mathematics that you get very, very philosophical on, like, the actual mathematics of things, and, like, what explains reality.
Where the closer you get to explanation of reality, the further you get from what reality looks like.
Yeah.
I mean, math is inherently, like, a philosophical discipline, I think, You know, it's really...
It all boils down to philosophy.
I mean, it really does, right? Like, scientists...
It really does all boil down to philosophy.
I think scientists, and particularly science undergrads... get a little snotty about being in science and tend to brush off philosophy, but philosophy is a super important discipline, and mathematics is largely an extension. Mathematics is just formal logic, really.
Yeah,
right?
Mm-hmm.
You start with a few basic axioms about numbers and the relationship between them, and then all of modern mathematics is just built on that. As like you were saying, things that are proven to be true.
Yeah,
about what. So starting with these basic axioms, what is then true based on the rules of formal logic that we have?
Yeah. Similarly, I don't think that science makes any actual sense outside of the context of philosophy.
No.
For that same reason. And pretending that it does, getting snooty about it and being like, I'm a scientist, not a philosopher, is just, like, kind of silly.
I think it's actually one of the...
But...
Sorry, continue. I didn't...
I very much want to hear what you're about to say, but I'll just preface that with this, I think, is also going to be the topic of the next podcast.
Oh,
actually.
Lean in then.
So we can, like, go a little bit further down this, and then let's save the rest of it for that, because I think that can be a entire set of conversations by itself.
All I was going to say is that I think it's actually... One of the things that's done terribly wrong about training scientists is that the lack of formal philosophical training.
I completely agree.
In the philosophy of science, even like my understanding of the philosophy of science is way behind where I feel it should be as a person becoming a scientist. Like, because I think there is, just like you're saying, I think there's this really large, important philosophical element to the practice of scientists, of science. That philosophers of science understand way better than actual scientists do, and really with just like a couple extra course requirements, like you could change that substantially, and nobody does.
Yeah, and I think our science would be a whole lot better for it, which is why I want to devote some real podcast time to discussing the philosophy of science and the underlying principles about why we make the decisions that we do and stuff like that, because it's so important and it's never discussed, and you only learn about it on the job while doing it.
Right.
Like, it's not something your advisor talks to you about.
No. I think it comes up a bit more when you're doing modeling work, because you at least sometimes have to justify why models matter. and that can be sort of a philosophical question, and getting into, like, whether math matters and what truth is and stuff. Not that I feel really equipped at all to talk about what truth is, but scientists do have this big, like, oh yes, we are the people who provide the truth. You know what I mean? Like, that's a big part of the job, and it is a big part of the job of trying to figure out, like, you know, like you were saying, we never acquire exact perfect truth, but we're going through this carving process of carving out human knowledge to get down to something that looks more like objective reality.
Yeah.
But I personally have a really insufficient understanding of what that actually means. And I feel like a lot of other people do too.
Agreed.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I have an okay understanding of it, but because I've, like, really, really actively sought that out.
Yeah. Awesome.
And because I have, like, it's not really a thing we talk about. Mm-hmm. I don't feel that I can, like, really, that I get much of an opportunity to refine what I'm thinking about in regards to it, because it's just like, okay, I've read a bunch of stuff, I've kind of synthesized it on my own, I try to apply it to my life, but I, like, so then we need to talk about more.
Cool, I'm into it.
Yeah, okay, great, then, yeah, that set of conversations will be coming up pretty soon. I'll let you know.
Good.
Yeah.
Cool. How do we go from here?
So, I think we're getting pretty close to time to wrap up. Sure. Yeah, and we've talked about a bunch of stuff. I feel good about wrapping up.
Cool.
You guys? Yep. Cool. Okay. Wait,
can we wrap up with Terrence Rant on levy flights?
Let's have a postscript with Terran's rant about levy flights.
I don't even remember my levy flight rant, really.
Let's finish this up, and then I'm pretty sure that we can prompt you enough on it.
There's enough
to
start
make
with.
That happen.
So much PTSD.
Yeah, like, not the levy flights.
Like, I went to the chemicals, and I looked, and you're just like seething, like shaking.
So I think, like Nate was saying a bit ago, that the
grocery shopping, that's what it was.
Yeah, that's what it was.
Take up that the take home message from this conversation is really that that data collection and modeling are both essential to the process of science together as an integrated thing. And some researchers do both as individuals, and I think that as an individual doing both, you make some sacrifices to both processes. Yeah. Like, I am definitely a data collection person who is learning to do more of the modeling and abstract stuff, and I'm super excited about it. And then there's people who approach things more from the mathematical side, who are less about the data collection, like Jonathan. And then there is, I think, my personal favorite. Like, I think that everybody should know a bit about doing all of the various things that they're working on, but my personal favorite mode of doing these things is what Nate and Taryn are doing, where one of you is doing more of the data collection.
Collaborating!
Kind of
stuff. Yay!
Yes, and one of you is doing more of the scary mathy stuff. because collaboration is what makes the world go round,
it really
right?
Is.
Like,
it really is.
You can't be an expert in everything. So if you know a bit about the other side of the thing, and the people you're working with know a bit about what you're doing, then these communications and collaborations and open lines of communication, I think, lead to really beautiful results.
Yeah.
And some really fantastic science.
Yeah, here, here. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Science is a social enterprise.
Yeah.
Sure.
The fun stuff, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's too complicated for one person to try to handle by themselves. Yeah, cool. Is there anything anyone else would like to say?
I think that was a pretty good summary.
No,
yep.
Adding more would just ruin that.
Okay,
hold on.
Great. Then thank you all for listening, and join us again soon for another exciting podcast. Next up, probably philosophy of science.
You've been listening to Danon, Nate, Taryn, and Jonathan on the Quest Podcast. To hear more of the podcast, visit questx.net/blog. To learn more about QuestX or to join us in our world of endless wonder, visit questx.net. Please be patient, our website is currently metamorphosing. Until next time, and every question is a quest.
Okay, great. That was a long enough pause. Levy flights.
I don't remember why I was that agitated.
Let me remind you on what I experienced. So I can't
prepare myself here.
Like, I'm upset now. So I
came into the cubicles. I walked in. I haven't been in the cubicles in a long time. I put my stuff down, and then she's just like,
By the way, listeners, we have this terrible, terrible system where all of us are in the same cubicle farm, so we're researchers, right? We've been trying to avoid desk job life our entire lives. And the administration have decided that the best thing for us, clearly, is to have a room full of 70-ish tiny cubicles. Like, I open my computer and that takes up my entire desk.
It's where the magic happens.
And we're all shoved together in, like, this big, sterile white room full of, like, 70-ish very tiny cubicles.
There was a moth at this point.
Great! Yes! Some life! Good!
A biodiverse environment.
Yes.
I had, like, five moths on my things, like, getting them out of there. Does somebody have food
I can introduce
somewhere?
Some geckos.
Please do.
That'll be fun. But anyway, Cube Farm life leads to some very interesting discussions and not much work since nobody wants to work.
Yeah, every time I go there, I just like it for the conversations.
Exactly, and then you leave because you're not getting anything done. So anyway.
So I went in one day and I have multiple desks that I could sit at and I could work at home, I could work in my lab, and I have this other it's weird. But I came in and I was just like, let me go sit in my old cubicle and see if I could just like work there. And Taryn's there, he has like a spread of papers. Spread of papers, but usually my
That's why I work at home all the time. I just sit on the floor and spread them all out and spread.
And, like, usually my ulterior motive was to go there and have a conversation with somebody. It's like, oh, there's Taryn.
So that's the down. Yes, procrastination!
I came to be yelled at and let me fly.
And I sit down, get my stuff, sit down, and he turns around very slowly. You know, like the evil genius in the movie who has a cat on his lap? I feel like he turned around slowly. So, have you heard about these Levy flights?
I don't even remember what got me worked up about it.
You got worked up because they assumed that whatever creature is represented doesn't know what the fuck is doing. It assumes that it just randomly goes at a certain distance and then fucks around in a certain area and then goes to a different distance and then fucks around that area. And the idea is to find some sort of nice equation that finds the ideal pattern of distance and then fucking around.
Yeah, right. So I think it was the...
Which makes no biological sense.
Well, it's like in this program that we're in, there's like people doing a lot of different kinds of modeling projects. And a weird amount of people are interested in Levy flights.
Yeah, and that's so
which
weird.
Are like jumping from place to place while you're foraging with a heavy tailed distribution. Which basically means that like... Most of the time you're doing little jumps, so you go pop, 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 in sort of this, you know, random walk pattern, and every once in a while you do a huge jump somewhere far away. And there's people sort of interested in, in this describing foraging, and I was just weirded out by, like, the amount of people doing that, because that seems like, if it is happening in ecology, it seems like something that is happening in unusual circumstances. And I think some of the, like, go-to,
I completely agree.
You know, we think this is happening with the wandering albatross. You know what I mean? Like floating around in these, like, oceanic environments looking for shoals of fish and stuff. And I was like, yeah, okay, like, maybe this is what's happening. And then I was thinking about it for a while, and I was wondering, I was like, so, if you were to put a motion, like a GPS tracker on a human... And they're, like, dicking around at home. And then they get in their car and they drive to the grocery store. And then they ping-pong around the grocery store for 45 minutes.
They
get back in their car and go home.
And
would that, if you fit a power law to that, does that come back as a levy flight? That was, I think the nature of my,
It went into that, but it started off with
my grocery store trip might.
Yeah.
Mine does for sure. Do.
But it started off with saying that you read this paper that actually found a levy flight that represented people in the Aborigine, of Australia. Like, they said, this is what's happening to the people in Australia. Like, people.
Oh, okay. This is... This is... I was like, I remember being worked up, but I don't remember why I was angry.
Yeah, they were applying it to human foraging patterns.
Yeah. No. You're totally right. That's why I was angry.
Yeah.
And it was because they were fitting a power law, or even just saying that hunter-gatherers. I can't remember whether it was Australia or might have been sub-Saharan Africa and somewhere.
Yeah, I thought you said Africa.
Yeah, yeah, but they were but they were doing that. They were putting GPS trackers on indigenous hunters.
Hey, Maasai being, dude, come over here. I'm just gonna slap this GPS tracker.
And then being like, yeah. Yeah, that looks like a heavy-tailed random walk to me. And I just thought that that was the dumbest shit that I've ever... Because it's just, like, even if it descriptively works like a levee flight,
yeah,
these are people with a huge depth of knowledge about their environments and the ecologies of the places they're living in. And they're going to places because they know those individual places have high probabilities of having the types of resources that they're looking for. And it just seems so fucking insulting to me.
Yeah.
You're like, No,
there's just a random walk-in.
Like a fucking albatross. Like, that was just like, come on.
Also, on the same note, like, Nate and I spent a long time the other day. How long was that? Like, at least 15 minutes, probably.
Yeah.
This
is after we talked?
Yes, it was right after we talked. Trying to figure out, like, what organisms might actually realistically follow this distribution of just, like, making a jump of a random length, like, a random long length to a place, then fucking around in that place, then making a jump to another, like, random place and fucking around in that place, and we couldn't think of any critters that would actually randomly do this.
Maybe jellyfish, but probably not even jellyfish.
Because jellyfish are planktonic.
Yeah.
That doesn't really work either, because they have zero control over their movement.
No, they could, like... They could still be doing it, but it's just the water column that's doing it.
Exactly! That's what I mean. It's like, their motion might follow...
Throw a neutrally buoyant GPS tracker in that water column and see if
and
it follows.
And see what happens. Yeah, exactly. Because, like, they probably do follow a similar sort of pattern to a levee flight. Because they have zero control over their distance locomotion. They can only control, like, movement within a range of, like, maybe 10 feet.
Yeah. Yeah, it was just... I think it's also... see if I can not get, like, beat up
also,
by some...
Also, that was a lovely jellyfish dance.
Thank you. I've been practicing.
This is what I do at night.
But I think this is part of... It actually sort of gets back to our modeling discussion about this continuum of the ways that people interact with modeling. So I think it's not irrelevant that most of the people doing levee flight work are physicists.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And physicists doing ecology is really funny. Physicists are like not bad funny, but just sort of what happens sometimes. And I think there's because physicists have amazing tool sets, right? For the most part, their mathematical and statistical training is really good, way better than most ecologists get.
Certainly.
And so they've got awesome tools for doing lots of really interesting science. But for the most part, they don't know fucking anything about ecology or natural history, right? And so a lot of the time, they seem to come up with problems where the physics of it is super interesting, like, to them, and, like, the math is super interesting, and ecologists are like, but who cares?
Yeah,
actually, like, but, like, what does this even matter?
Yeah.
And so at first, this used to make me, like, a lot more, like, irked somehow. Like, I had trouble, like, accepting this, but now I'm just in a place where it's, like, really what they're doing is physics with an ecological skin on top of it.
Yeah.
And that lets me be like, okay, that's fine. They're just doing the thing. And I think it's actually cool, though. People coming in from things like math and physics and all sorts of places with different and important skills and helping us understand this big clusterfuck that is the living world.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's actually super valuable, but it used to really...
Well, and this is actually where I think that collaboration is so important, because in order for a model to make any sense at all, and, like, we've established already that models are incredibly important to being able to say anything and, like, actually use the information that we have to do shit. But in order for a model to be useful, you have to understand the system that you're modeling in some reasonably good fashion.
Yeah.
And, like, there's ways to get around that. Like, a physicist should be a physicist, you know? A physicist should not need to have ecological training. And, yeah, there's, like, a ton of great, fantastic physics concepts and crazy physics math that we should be applying to ecology.
Yeah.
Because it's good shit, yeah. and it's meaningful shit.
Mm-hmm.
But physicists, like, either should start to become an ecologist, or should get an ecologist. And really, you should just get an ecologist. And, like, this is really... I'm hoping to have a similar conversation with one of my other friends that can kind of be appended to this at some point, because, like, I have a really good friend who, she's a statistician, and I didn't, the last job that I worked before coming here, I worked at the University of Washington in a, basically in a plant lab, and we were trying to make maps of, how sunlight hits the forest floor, and, how it filters through the trees on the Olympic Peninsula and hits the forest floor, and ultimately how this affects seedling growth.
Yeah.
Figuring out how to make these maps was, like, an adventure on its own. That whole thing where I think I've told you about with, like, making the little carts that moved on a line through the woods.
No.
Okay.
I've definitely never heard the story before.
Okay, great. Well, I can tell you that story later. She had very little training in biology or ecology, and I did not know this before signing up for this job, and I was just hired as a tech.
Mm-hmm.
And we spent, our entire first field season having this weird set of arguments that neither of us understood.
Sounds about right.
Because as a mathematician, she would be like, we need a sample size of X, and I would be like, that is impossible. and at the time, I was just, a pure ecologist, yeah, right? Yeah. I had no actual math background whatsoever, but a lot of field experience. And she'd just be like, in order to get statistical significance, we need a sample size of X. And I'd be like, we'll be here for years.
Yeah. Good luck with that.
you're doing a master's, right? No.
Yeah.
And we just had, this long series of very weird conversations where ultimately, by the end of our first field season, I understood a hell of a lot more about math. She understood a hell of a lot more about ecology.
Mm-hmm.
But neither of us knew anything at the beginning. And it was just through, this series of really weird, this is what we need, and I can't make this work kind of things that we came to what ended up being a really good, solid project that told us lots of exciting shit. And I think that that's, we all need to try to learn to understand each other better, but also, mm-hmm. It's so much more efficient.
Yeah.
And also so much just, scientifically better to just get experts in different fields together to work on stuff.
Mm-hmm. My little scientist, collaboration is magic. I'm glad you like that.
I'm just laughing because she's laughing.
I feel like I'm going to have a really interesting series of dreams based on that. When I do, I'm going to tell you every single one of them.
I look forward to it. Wonderful.
Yeah, great. It's really important to know what you're modeling and to be actually modeling what you think you're modeling. Yay!
Yeah, this is very true.
Yeah, I feel like, theoretical ecologists, or even more so physicists versus, practical ecologists, just go about this in two completely different ways.
Completely miss each other.
Right, as ecologists, we're like, okay, we want to find a method to explain our data. Whereas some physicists are like, we want to find data that explains our method, and I can see from both sides, because, on the one hand, we could be like, okay, well, yeah, you guys have this, fancy model, but it doesn't apply to anything in the real world, that what you're trying to fit into for its function is not a real world scenario, versus, you know, it could be like, oh, we have this cool data, but I'm going to use this method to analyze it. And then the physicist could be like, well, you're totally abusing, you know, that equation or that model. That's not what its function to do. You just want a pretty fucking plot. And
our math also is screaming is, now.
We all just want a pretty fucking plot, yeah.
Right.
So, yeah, it is important to get that communication in between the two things.
Yeah. Okay,
cool.
Great, good postscript or whatever that was.
Deviant rambling.
Pretty much sums up my life, I think. Okay, great. Thank you guys very much. This was a good talk.
Yeah.